Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to this committee this afternoon to give you a brief introduction to the board, but a little more extensive than the introduction you've each already had through the process of registering the campaign committee and filing reports with us. I want to talk a little bit about the board and its operations, just give you some facts and figures so that you have a better idea of the scope of the amount of work that we actually do each year. I want to speak a bit about the rationale for having a campaign finance board. Why does a state, in fact, why does every state in the union have some kind of an equivalent of the campaign finance board? I want to talk about what we've done over the last few years to innovate, to allow ourselves to continue to both continue our services and improve our services without asking for more money and how we expect to do that in the future. And finally, I want to say a little bit about public subsidy programs in general, not to advocate for a particular position or program, but to explain what the concept of those programs are and why they are more than just a budget item. They're really a policy item, and this, of course, is the policy committee that deals with that particular item with respect to Minnesota state elections. I've already introduced myself. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce one other key member of our staff who's here with me. If you don't talk to me about a complex matter, you're probably going to talk to Jeff Sigurdsson, who's my assistant director. And I'd like Jeff to stand up. This is Jeff Sigurdsson. Many of you have already probably talked to him. If I'm not available, he usually is. If it should happen that I'm in a committee and there's a conflict, maybe Jeff will appear before this committee. And we really share the duties for operating the campaign finance board at the staff level. The board was actually created in 1974. This was in the era that we sometimes refer to as the Watergate era when we're talking about politics. It was an era where there was unlimited money in politics, lots of cash changing hands, and there actually was corruption as a result of that immense amount of money that was totally unregulated and undisclosed. The federal government saw that as a problem and enacted campaign finance reform in 1974, and Minnesota followed suit in that same year. And there was a big lawsuit challenging those regulations on the basis of First Amendment free speech rights. And in 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court came down with the biggest decision ever regarding campaign finance, and that decision, Buckley versus Valeo, still gives us most of the guiding principles for regulating campaign finance even to this day. Minnesota amended its statute at that time to bring it into conformance with the Buckley decision. When the board was first formed in the 70s, it was called the State Ethics Commission, later became the Ethical Practices Board, and that name reflects the fact that back then money in politics often wasn't a matter of ethics. We've moved a long ways from that now because we simply have a system of disclosure and regulation, and violating a campaign finance provision or filing a report late is no longer considered an ethical violation in the way that we would normally think about ethics. It's really a violation of an administrative or statutory rule. And so the board's name was changed in the 90s to better reflect the shift away from ethics to simply regulation in what we do. You've all had interactions with one or more of our staff, no doubt. Probably not very many of you have had interactions with the board. The board consists of six members. They're all appointed by the governor, and they have staggered terms. So when a governor has been governor for 4 years, he or she will have appointed all of the members. And so the current members on the board were all appointed by Governor Pawlenty. There are two slots that just expired in January. Those members continue to serve until their replacements are named. So Governor Dayton has two spots that he can fill. And we also have one appointment that hasn't been confirmed from Governor Pawlenty's last month. So we will have at least one and maybe as many as three appointments coming before this committee to vote on. The board's appointments, unlike any others, are approved by both the House and the Senate acting separately. So right now we have a former Republican legislator and a former Democratic legislator. That's a statutory requirement. And then we have people from both parties typically on the board. It's a mixed partisan board, but we find that the board members typically operate in a nonpartisan way once they come and take their seats at that board table. Typically, they meet once a month with staff handling the day-to-day operations. Those operations are generally delegated to the executive director. And the board hires the executive director, and I hire everybody else. The board can fire me, and I can terminate anybody except the executive director. That's up to the board as well. I want to give you some numbers. You don't have to write these down, but they're just to give you a scope of what we do. There are 8 permanent staff, by the way, on the board, 8 full-time staff. We used to have 9, but because of improved technology and shifting customer needs, namely putting stuff on the internet so people didn't have to come to our office, we were able to restructure, and in that restructuring, we eliminated 1 position. So from 4 years ago, we're already down 11%. I say that because if we have to drop another 15%, it's going to be very difficult for us. We have a lot of entities and individuals registered and reporting to us. Campaign committees, more than 800. Party units, more than 300. Political committees and funds, about 400. So we have a total of more than 1,500 entities registered in the campaign finance program. We have more than 1,300 lobbyists registered, and we have more than 2,100 public officials filing economic interest statements with us. So that's a lot of paper that we have to get in, a lot of data that we have to process, and we are very data-driven. And we try to be as computerized as we can so we don't drown in the numbers in the paper. A lot of dollars pass through the oversight of the Campaign Finance Board. I just want to talk about the last election year, 2010, and then not the whole year, just up to your pre-general election report, which, as you remember, cut off 2 weeks before the general election. So there'll be a fair amount of activity in addition to what I have to tell you about here. Contributions received by candidates in that period, $19 million. By all other registered entities, $49 million. So we've looked at more than $68 million in contributions coming into the system in 2010. And all of that goes into our databases for both electronic and manual compliance examinations. Total expenditures by candidates, $23 million. By others, $20 million, not counting independent expenditures, so $44 million in expenditures. And another $12 million in independent expenditures by these new groups that can use corporate money. So $57 million or thereabouts in expenditures. And all of this gets into our system, and then we examine all of those materials for compliance. One might ask why we do this. Why does the state spend money? What does anybody care about campaign finance? It's still important, even though it's not so much a matter of ethics anymore. People have come to expect and understand and believe that the people that they vote for public office are not going to be unduly influenced by big money and undisclosed contributions. The board states this in its mission, which is to promote public confidence in state government decision-making through the development, administration, and enforcement of disclosure and other programs. I think the key sentence is we exist to promote public confidence in state government decision-making. The whole idea behind a disclosure board is so that the people of the state can be confident when they vote, and when you vote as an elected representative, they can be confident in your decisions and that your decisions are based on your constituents' interests and not on some moneyed interest who has somehow gotten you into the position that you're in. I think that's worked in Minnesota. I think the fact that we have high voter turnout demonstrates that it's worked. People still have confidence in the elections and in the people they elect. I think some of the figures I'll give you a little bit later on about participation in donations to campaigns also shows that people have great confidence in both the system and the people that get elected as a result of the system. The board does have 3 goals. One is to facilitate easier and more universal compliance with the statute. We recognize that violations are almost always inadvertent. I've been director for 3 years now, and I have probably had 2 or 3 violations that were more than inadvertent. They were either completely intentional or people knew the law and sort of circumvented it or went around it. But we know that mostly everybody wants to comply, and so our job is really educational as much as anything else. We try to do that through letters and materials. We do it through in-person, and we do it very often in one-on-one conversations. If you've called the board, very often you will get the person you're calling right away. If not, you should be getting a phone call back, typically the same day. If not, let me know, because that's the way we operate. We also try to provide fair and consistent enforcement. As I say, board members become nonpartisan once they join the board. Almost every decision our board ever makes is unanimous, with very few exceptions. And we try to help citizens become more informed about the campaign finance system so that they will be able to have that level of confidence in elected officials and in candidates for office that our system is designed to provide. The board runs, we think and hope, much like a business or a corporation. The board itself would be the board of directors. They meet typically on a monthly basis to make policy decisions, to provide direction or grant authority to the executive director. They make determinations on complaints. They issue guidance in the form of advisory opinions and in other ways. So they do exactly what a high-level board would do. The day-to-day operations then is handled by the executives, I and Jeff, and by the line staff who work all the time. And we do work all the time. I'll come back to this again, although this isn't a budget hearing, but when I see discussion about 15% cuts in state budgets, small agencies typically think, well, that's all going to go to the big agencies and we're safe. We don't think that anymore. We don't know. But I think about my 8 staff, and if I see more than 9 hours a day of somebody just sitting around doing nothing, because that's 15% of 8 staff people, 9 hours a day, it just doesn't happen. So we'll see what happens in the legislature. We recognize the problems. We're certainly not going to be asking anybody for any more money, and we'll continue to try and cut our expenses. But that kind of cut, people will notice when they call up the board and ask for assistance, because it'll be one-plus person not there anymore. We have done some innovation. We are hoping to have some money left at the end of this biennium to spend on a couple of important projects. One is conversion to the new state phone system, which is a voice over IP phone system. There's a fairly significant, even for us, upfront investment in the range of $10,000 to $12,000. We've been saving really for about 4 years, but we only can carry over for 2, so we've been saving for that. But that'll have a payoff of about 3.5 years. So if we still have that money to invest in this new phone system this biennium, 3.5 years from now, we'll be looking at net savings. And we're also going to spend some money to remodel some front-end office space that's not productively used anymore, to give us a couple of workstations so that maybe we can get an intern or a volunteer to come in. We're working on an electronic records project. We're going to have lots of scanning to do. And certainly, even if we have our full complement of 8 staff, we would benefit greatly from some additional volunteer unpaid labor to come in and do that. But we have no place to put them right now. So there's a couple things we'd like to spend some of our money on. I want to just put in a plug for one state program that I think is exceptional. It was enacted, I think, about 4 years ago. It's called the Small Agency Resource Teams. I've talked about it at each of the committees I've appeared before. The legislature appropriated to the Department of Administration some additional budget funds to hire people in human resources and in financial management. And those people were there to provide HR and financial management services to small agencies who typically couldn't have the expertise in-house to do those things right. We did them. Everybody did them. But it was inefficient and not as professional as a dedicated staff could do those things. And we still, of course, make purchasing and HR decisions, but all of the complicated actions of getting those decisions into the state systems are done by the smart teams for us. And in my opinion, that has improved the level of professionalism of the work that we've done. It's certainly improved our compliance, which was already good, but it's improved it with all the state purchasing and financial policies and procedures. We will be having some legislative recommendations that I'll be talking to your leadership, both at the body, the leadership of the body, and the leadership of this committee, to determine which of those will be brought forward. Just want to take a minute to tell you about our general approach. We will be looking at concepts of simplification and better service. Better service, we will be suggesting a couple of ways where the board could be granted some additional authority, and I'm reluctant to do that because we're not asking for additional resources, but to give us some legal authority to answer questions that we already answer without legal authority. So people come to us, we answer their question, and then we say, by the way, you really need to talk to your own legal advisors because this is outside of our jurisdiction. The other area is simplification. We've identified a couple of reporting requirements that really are not well designed to provide meaningful disclosure to the public. We'll be recommending that those be removed. And we're also going to be recommending that the thresholds for getting into the campaign finance system be adjusted. This is both to eliminate the work for some extremely small committees, but also there's a threat out there right now in the form of legal action. It's in Colorado right now, not Minnesota, but challenging the threshold at which a candidate or a ballot question committee or a political committee has to register with a board like ours. And the courts are looking at those levels, and based on the levels we have, we're concerned that they may be too low. So by moving them up, we keep our statute constitutional. At the same time, we exempt the smallest of spenders from having to get into a complicated disclosure system.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. What are those levels right now? When you mentioned
right now? Right now, a candidate has to register if they raise or spend more than $100. One of the problems we've seen with that is that a candidate may decide that they want to seek endorsement, so they're actually raising money to influence their nomination, and that counts in that pool. They don't get the endorsement, and so they're never on the ballot, and yet they've had to register with and at least file one report with the Campaign Finance Board. The board's recommendation, which is, of course, subject to this body's review and better judgment, would be at least $250 for that initial threshold before you would have to register with the board. That would keep a few committees out. I'm more concerned about the ballot question and independent expenditure question thresholds, and also, for that matter, the political committee and fund thresholds. Those are also $100. And with regard to ballot questions and independent expenditures, the courts are concerned because the whole concept of influencing a candidate with money doesn't exist with those kind of committees. You can't influence a candidate by donating to a ballot question. The district federal court and now the circuit court in Colorado have ruled that a $250 threshold for ballot question committees is too low to be constitutional. So our board is proposing that those thresholds be raised to $1,000, and I think there's some concern about that, although in the last session when we passed the when you passed at the board's urging and with the board's help, the new independent expenditure committee and fund legislation, there was concern then about this $100 threshold because the local businessman couldn't even run a full-page ad in a local newspaper or even a half a page without getting into a campaign finance system. It was Representative Coles who was concerned about that, and it was his Joe the Barbershop analogy that was talked about quite a bit. This would essentially make an exemption for those businesses who want to run an ad and not still be in the system. So this will be a topic that I hope to be bringing forward to you. And there are some other things. Those are sort of the high points of what I'd be bringing forward. If I have just a few more minutes, I just want to say a couple of words about public subsidy programs and campaign finance programs in general. I mentioned the Buckley versus Vallejo case. That case challenged a whole lot of what the federal government enacted in its first campaign finance regulation attempt. And that court recognized several very important principles that we still carry forward today. The first principle, which some people disagree with, but it's law, is money is speech when it comes to campaign finance. The courts have recognized you can't get your message out if you can't spend money. And so for practical purposes, the ability to raise and spend money is a First Amendment issue when we're talking about campaign finance. The court said two things about limits. Number one, you cannot limit the amount an individual can spend to get himself or herself elected. You cannot do it, period. And number two, even if the candidate is using other people's money, you can't limit the total amount that the candidate can spend. So how do we have these regulations in Minnesota that keep our election costs down? Well, the court did say that you can limit individual contributions coming into a candidate. So how much I can donate or you can donate to a candidate can be limited. We just can't limit how many of those that they can take altogether. And the court said you can allowed, you can have disclosure, which of course we do. What Minnesota has done is created a voluntary system of campaign finance limits. We do by agreement what we can't do by imposition. In exchange for certain benefits, typically in the form of public subsidy, a candidate signs an agreement, it's a contract, where that candidate agrees to voluntarily limit their spending and to voluntarily limit how much they will put in of their own money into their campaign. And in the past, we've had high 90 percentiles of candidates signing those public subsidy agreements. That dropped a bit in the last election. So we do through public subsidy what we can't do otherwise, and that's why public subsidy is a policy question as much, if not more, than a budget question. Now, in the past, our public subsidy program consisted of two parts. One, the direct checks that we get, and many of you got in the last election. Secondly, was the contribution refund program, which was defunded in the last election, and there are bills going forward to permanently remove that from statute, not just to defund it, but to remove the statutes that permit that. So we would be left with one component, the direct payment component of public subsidy. What's the effect of having this program? Well, Minnesota has some of the least expensive elections in the country. And elections that are financed by donors who would be classified as small donors. A study in 2006 of the states who had governors up for election as well as legislative bodies included 33 states. In that study, more than 60% of the contributions to candidates in Minnesota came from people who gave $250 or less, and that was the highest of any state in these small contributions. Only 24% of the money to candidates in Minnesota came from donors of more than $1,000, and that was the lowest percentage of any of these 33 states coming from large donors. Another fact that I think is amazing and is a tribute to the legislative bodies in Minnesota, and I think the system in general, is that if you look at all of the voting age population in Minnesota, 4.11% of all of those voters actually made a contribution to a candidate. And that was the fourth highest of the 33 states studied. Now, part of that might have been because of the contribution refund program, which existed back then. They could give $50 and get it back. It will be interesting to see what percentage we have when we are at the end of 2010 to see what happens when we've had a period without that program. So we have elections that cost in the range of $35,000 for a House candidate, probably double that for a Senate candidate. Compare that, for example, and it's probably a bad example, to six congressional district where the two candidates there in the federal office raised $15 million. I mean, in 15B, which is part of that district, the whole election cost less than $50,000. Everybody was part of the public subsidy program.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Senator Peterson had a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, do you have a sense for right now that contribution rebate program, how much staff time that would save you if that is eliminated or remains as is right now?
Sure. That's a very good question. We've done fiscal notes on it for the budget committees, and the fiscal notes indicate that there would be zero effect on us, and that may surprise people, but that's a program that's primarily a Department of Revenue program. We give out the receipt books. That's all we do. We don't track them even, and revenue processes the refunds, and the money for the program is appropriated to revenue, so it won't have any effect on us.
Thank you.
I've completed, so I'll stand for questions.
Okay, thank you. I did. Members have any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And I know this is too early because the January 30th reporting deadline has not approached yet. But I really am kind of curious. We'll have to get a report when it's available about the level of contributions without the refund program. I was pleasantly surprised myself. I was thinking the worst would happen and all my contributors would dry up and go away because they couldn't get a refund, and I was pleasantly surprised how many people continued to give, some in smaller amounts, but they still were contributing, and I'm just wondering if that's the experience statewide or not. And I have you any preliminary information on it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we have, this is an interesting program in that it's funded on a biennial basis with a fiscal year budget, and yet it's paid out on a calendar year basis. So defunding it for a fiscal year really only cut the funding completely for calendar year 2010. So in calendar year 2009, the use of the program was almost at its regular level. People actually knew it was going to be defunded beginning July 1, and party units and candidates were out there getting those contributions in. Of course, in 2010, it will be zero. And in 2011, presuming it gets defunded, it'll be zero again. And I don't have a sense. Anecdotally, I've heard, particularly with new candidates and maybe what we might think are less viable candidates, that they've had more trouble raising money because they couldn't use that program.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair and Mr. Goldsmith. I think as candidates, we're aware that you're asking us all to move to the software program, and I forget the deadline, but I'd be curious again, do you have a sense for how much staff time that'll save once you have all the candidates using the campaign reporter software?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we haven't quantified it, but when I was before these bodies 2 years ago, when we first introduced that bill and it was passed last year, we looked at our funding for 8 staff at that time, and we looked at how that funding went out over the next 4 years, which would take us through this biennium and the next. And it was our expectation, and still is my expectation, that assuming there's no new funding and assuming that there's some increases in employee payroll, although that may not be the case, we were going to start decreasing our staff complement, first going to a partial on our 8th, and that the implementation of the software would allow us to do that. And so that's still my expectation, which is why I don't expect to be coming back for more money, even if there are some staff increases. I don't have it quantified. And let me say one other thing. There are quite a lot of things in our office that currently aren't being done, and some of those should be done and would be done if once we have more electronic filers.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, I would just follow up just to thank you or compliment you, Mr. Goldsmith, on that. I mean, I know I don't recall his last name, but I know there's a gentleman named John that works specifically with that software and has been very helpful to our campaign specifically, and I think that's a good example of trying to take your department in the right direction, even though you may have some candidates fighting that a little bit, but I think that's the future, and clearly it's a way to save some money, and it's not an unreasonable request for candidates to be filing all that information electronically through the software program. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith, you mentioned that the new, or not the new system, but the current campaign finance system has eliminated corruption, or that there was corruption prior to this system. Could you just give us some examples of that?
What I was referring to, Mr. Chair and members, was in the 70s, and I wasn't following it that long, but it, at the federal level, at least, there were stories, and to me this is anecdotal, but there was corruption at the federal level, and I don't know that there was corruption in Minnesota. I have no evidence of that. But Minnesota, nevertheless, followed the federal lead in enacting campaign finance regulation at that time.
And, Mr. Goldsmith, do you do analysis or reports on the, you know, like the activity of interest groups or other types of PACs, as far as what percentages they might spend to influence elections?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good question. That's actually one of the things that I mentioned to Senator Peterson that we don't do very much of and we would like to do more of, but we haven't had the time. I really hope that we can find the time once these year-end reports come in, at least to do some analysis of the money flow of these new independent expenditure organizations, because it's very confusing. Corporations, both for-profit and nonprofit, gave to registered entities who gave to other registered entities. And so there was a lot of money churning around, and it would be, if we can possibly find the time, I would like to do some analysis so we can see what actually happened. But up to this point, the board's resources have only permitted it to do the gross type of analysis, such as total spending and so on, which to me doesn't seem particularly helpful to anybody who's looking at it.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, in non-election years, is it less busy and do you have more time to do that kind of activity, or are you pretty much busy from regardless of whether it's an election year or not?
Mr. Chair, we always hope to be less busy during a non-election year. Somehow it doesn't always turn out that way. We typically have a fairly full legislative agenda. Of course, staff, most of the staff have more time, and right now they're working on a couple of major things. We're working on the next version of the software that will support commercial vendors who want to use it to file a report in our format. We're working on our annual report, our campaign finance summary, and so on. But hopefully there will be, and typically, yes, a non-election year, at least for the operations staff, is less busy than an election year.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I should really follow up on my last question, too. Have you really heard from candidates or campaign committees that would rather not use the software filing system, or what kind of input have you had from people in that regard?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we've heard, again, this is mostly anecdotal. We haven't had anybody come to us and say, I'm not going to do it. But we have a few committees who've been around for a long, long time where a relative or an old friend is the treasurer, and they typically file on paper returns. The statute does provide for a waiver for good cause, and it's been the board's approach to this particular question that we aren't going to force somebody to change treasurers to comply with the law or force somebody to learn to use a computer who's never used a computer. What we found is that every year the new committees registering with us, a higher and higher percent opt into the software automatically. And so by attrition, that number of non-users is going down. So we don't expect it to be a serious problem.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, there's currently a law on the books that restricts public officials from being involved in, let's say, a C4 type organization. That would be an organization, a political organization, or maybe, for lack of a better term, an independent expenditure group that would be endorsing or advocating a cause or endorsing candidates. And I think it came, if my memory serves me correctly, it occurred about 20 or 25 years ago when the legislature was aware of what was known then as friends of committees, where a legislator would make a political action group with his name. It would be called Friends of Warren Limmer. And then it would be a private funding pool that would gather funding. And then I don't know how they did it at that time, but the money in some way or another benefited that individual. And since then, we've restricted not only the public official from participating in that. I believe a public official could be employed as an employee of a C3 organization that would be giving information out to the public regarding, oh, let's say, legislative records or voting records, information to the public. But that's kind of as far as the law allows a public official to do. But the bill was created, or the law was created basically to stop the practice of friends of committees.
Correct.
Now, if a legislator happened to be hired into a C4 organization, let's say they were employed in it, ran it, directed it, as long as that legislator didn't get a gain of any kind out of it, would that be violating? Would that public official be violating the law?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, you're right. This was a bill passed into law that was to eliminate the Friends of Committees, and it says essentially that a candidate may not have a committee other than the candidate's principal campaign committee and may not be in direct or indirect control of any other political committee or fund registered with the board. To the extent that, for example, the C4 Corporation operated only to do issue advertising or other activity that was not part of the campaign finance system. And by the way, Minnesota law does not cover issue advertising. You can say candidate A supports this proposition, which isn't good for Minnesota. Call candidate A and tell him to change his mind. That's not covered by Minnesota campaign finance law. To the extent that a C4 corporation did only those types of things, a public official or a candidate could be part of that C4 or could operate that C4. I think the problem would arise under the current law once if the C4 then forms a political committee or fund that will actually donate to other candidates or run advertisements directly advocating the election of candidates. Then the question would be whether the candidate who is an officer of the C4 is in direct or indirect control of that committee and would therefore be violating that statute. So it hasn't been looked at for a long time.
Yeah,
correct.
I know. Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking is it seems like the Supreme Court has made some rather liberal interpretations of independent expenditure use. Unlimited amounts, candidates can spend their money unlimited on their own election. But we seem to get really upset if we happen to advocate for someone else on the other side of the state in an organized independent expenditure fashion. We meaning a public official.
Right.
And I'm just kind of extrapolating from the decisions made by the Supreme Court on other independent expenditures. I'm not sure if we're now kind of overstepped our interpretation of our own laws. I think one can certainly stop or prohibit the Friends of Committee use and still be an avid employee of a C4 organization. And whether or not we're a C3 just gives out information like a voter guide on how legislator was voted. Versus a C4 where you're actually doing direct advocating or endorsing of candidates. I'm not so sure if we aren't violating someone's constitutional rights by limiting a person, namely a public official, who wants to express himself in that way. I know you didn't make the law, so I'm not blaming you on it at all. But the legislature from 20, 25 years ago seemed to be, I thought it was a rather limited intent to stop the Friends of Committees, but we seem to have extended it beyond that.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think you may be right. I haven't looked at this particular statute in a constitutional context until you mentioned it. I'm thinking about it now, of course. I'm not sure if the interpretation of the statute goes beyond constitutional limits or if it's the statute itself that might go beyond constitutional limits. It's interesting to note something that most people don't know, and that is that candidates are not actually prohibited from making independent expenditures. Only those candidates who sign a public subsidy agreement are then prohibited by their agreement not to do so. So there's already sort of a built-in conflict then between that provision that says candidates can make independent expenditures and a provision that would preclude them from being part of a committee or in control of a committee that does the same thing. It's certainly a topic that would be ripe for reexamination in the new constitutional context that we find ourselves.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for campaign finance? Mr. Goldsmith, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
overview of the Metropolitan Mosquito Control. And Mr. Stark, welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Stark. I'm the Executive Director for the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District. I appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee this afternoon. Bear with me for a second here. I've got some slides that I'd like to use for... for my presentation. There we go. As I mentioned, I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I work for the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District. I'm the executive director. I've been the executive director for almost 5 years. In May of 2011 will be my fifth year. I've worked for the organization for approximately 30 years. The Metropolitan Mosquito Control District was established in 1958. We were established under Minnesota Statutes 473.701 through 473.716. We are governed by a board of 18 elected county commissioners. We serve the 7 metropolitan counties of Anoka, Washington, Ramsey, Dakota, Scott, Hennepin, and Carver County. Service area of approximately 2,900 square miles. Within that 2,900 square miles, we serve a population of about 2.7 million people. Within that habitat, or within that area, service area, we have 70,000 breeding sites. These are areas that mosquitoes develop in, and 26,000 wooded habitat where mosquitoes kind of hang out during the daytime as adult mosquitoes. We have a staff of 55 regular full-time employees, and we hire 208, in 2010 we hired 208 seasonal inspectors that come on anywhere from the beginning of March through the 1st of June and then work into the fall through the mosquito season, usually around the second week in September. We are a special taxing district. We have taxing authority, and our levy in 2010 was $16.7 million. We reduced our levy in 2010 by 5%. We've kept our levy flat for calendar year 2011. There's a list of county commissioners that sit on our board. We have 3 county commissioners, elected officials, that sit on our board from Anoka, Hennepin, Ramsey and Dakota County, and then 2 county commissioners from Carver, Scott, and Washington County. Our current board chair is Janice Rettman, Commissioner Janice Rettman from Ramsey County. Our current vice chair is Commissioner Jim Ishii from Carver County, and our current secretary is Commissioner Robin West from Anoka County. Well, biology lesson here. Mosquitoes basically go from laying their eggs either on the damp, dry ground or on top of water and then progress through their life cycle through the water. They go from egg to larva to pupa, and then eventually the adults emerge. And I've got some slides that kind of talk a little bit about how that happens. We've got 2 different families of mosquitoes in Minnesota. We have some mosquitoes that lay their eggs like you see on the upper left-hand part of this slide. The female mosquito will lay her eggs singly on the damp, dry ground and then wait for either the snow to melt or spring or summer rainfall to submerge the eggs. You'll see these mosquito eggs will darken over time, kind of protects them from nature. And actually in Minnesota, these eggs can stay viable or able to hatch for about 7 years in Minnesota. Even if they don't come in contact with water, if they stay in an area and then sometime within that 7-year period become submerged, they will hatch and eventually become adult mosquitoes if they go uncontrolled. The mosquitoes that lay their eggs singly like that are mainly pest mosquitoes, mainly just ones that are out there bothering us. They really aren't associated with disease transmission. Those mosquitoes are like the ones you see in the right-hand part of this slide. We have another family of mosquitoes that lay their eggs in a raft up on top of the water. They're not quite as dependent on heavy rainfalls throughout the summer. They look for more permanent water habitat that they'll lay eggs on top of in a raft, and then those eggs, once they come in contact with the water, will hatch into another life form called a mosquito larva. And here we have some mosquito larvae that are hanging head down from the surface of the water. They breathe through a siphon, a little breathing tube, not unlike a whale or a dolphin. They're continually bobbing up and down in the water, feeding on bacteria, degrading organic matter, fungus, really anything small enough to kind of filter feed through. And then they'll progress through four stages in this. They kind of molt like a snake. They shed their skin and go into another what are called instars. So there are four instars as they progress through this larval stage.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask how big are those larvae? It's hard to picture.
You know, it kind of depends on how much food is in the water, but they range in size from about an eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch in length. They're not very long. When mosquito eggs first hatch into larvae, they're almost transparent, really hard to see to the human eye, but then when they're in the fourth instar, they can get to be about a quarter of an inch in length, and you can determine what they look like kind of by this action they make through the water. They're sometimes referred to as wrigglers. Then they turn into a pupa, which is kind of like a cocoon. Adult mosquito is inside of this pupal case going through its final development. The adult mosquitoes will emerge fully developed. They're fully emerged developed adults. They do this normally real early in the water, real quiet water areas. The adult mosquitoes, as you'll see, will kind of come out of their pupal case, form a little surface tension, enables them to stand on top of the water for a few minutes to dry off, but then they'll right away fly off. And right away, the female will start looking for a blood meal. Female mosquitoes are the only mosquitoes that bite us. They need our blood for the nutrients to develop their eggs. Male mosquitoes are primarily vegetarian, feed mainly on plant nectars. And that whole process from egg to adult is done in the water. And it's really determined by how long it takes is really determined by the temperature of the water. In the springtime, when the water is really, really cold, it takes the mosquitoes 4 or 5 weeks to develop. So from a control standpoint, we've got a fairly extensive period of time to get to all those 70,000 breeding sites around the metropolitan area, try to control them and keep from hatching. In the summertime, when the water's really warm, that's greatly sped up. They can go through that same development in as little as 7 days. So from a control standpoint, it becomes a kind of a crunch time in the middle of the summer. Habitat, floodwater mosquitoes, as I say, lay their eggs singly on the damp, dry ground. They're looking for areas like that are dry most of the time, but then will fill with water for a week or two after heavy rainfall. An area like on the left-hand part of this slide, water runs down into this lower depression area, stays in there for a while, long enough for the mosquitoes to develop. Little woodland ponds, as we see in the right-hand side, really areas that are dry most of the time, but then will hold water just long enough for them to develop in the summertime. Freeway ditches, areas that are primarily dry most of the time. The permanent habitat of mosquitoes, the one that I said are associated with disease transmission, they like more permanent water settings. And when I say permanent water, I don't want you to get the impression that we're talking about huge open bodies of water like lakes or moving water like streams or rivers. They're really looking for areas that have some emerging vegetation where the water is around for maybe a month in the summertime. And as I say, these mosquitoes aren't quite as relying upon the constant rainfall like the other mosquitoes. They can always find some permanent habitat where they can go lay a raft of eggs. Those mosquitoes will hatch, and I'll explain to you how they're implicated in disease transmission. Field map. I've got a picture of a field map here. The Mosquito Control District maintains one of the most complete and up-to-date wetland inventories in the metropolitan area. As I say, we've been in existence for over 50 years, so we've gone out and field-checked most of the wetland areas in the metropolitan area over the last 50 years. We put those on a map. We include a data set with those. We share those with a number of different entities, whether they're watershed districts or cities with regards to their wetland inventories. We're not delineators by any means, but we at least have the basic data that folks around the metropolitan area use and that we use when we are looking for mosquitoes. We've got a data set here. We'll know after a significant rainfall which sites or which of these areas are going to produce mosquitoes, what types of mosquitoes we found them in the past, and it really helps us direct our resources to be efficient with regards to controlling mosquitoes. The surveillance, everything we do is predicated on surveillance. The surveillance part of it can be pretty rudimentary. You see on the left-hand slide here, there are many times when we go out and just visually dip into a site with a little plastic or metal container and look collect the mosquito larvae, send them down to our lab in St. Paul. We have entomologists who identify mosquitoes. We've got 50 different species of mosquitoes in Minnesota, and each of them have their own little niche, their own little personality. We only target the types of mosquitoes that either transmit disease or aggressively bite humans. There are certain species of mosquitoes that prefer to bite cold-blooded animals. They really don't bother humans. They don't transmit disease. We don't target them for control. On the right-hand side here, this is one of the traps we use to collect adult mosquitoes. It's a CO2, actually a dry ice baited trap. We put a piece of dry ice in that canister at the top. Carbon dioxide is given off as the dry ice evaporates. That's the main thing that attracts mosquitoes to us is carbon dioxide. So basically, we try to fool the adult mosquitoes into thinking there's someone standing out there all evening. They're attracted into that trap and they're caught alive. We put that information onto maps, so again, we have a fairly good idea of the densities of mosquitoes, what types of mosquitoes we've got in certain areas as we direct our control efforts. We are primarily a larval control program, meaning we target immature mosquitoes while they develop in the wetlands throughout the metropolitan area. We use two primarily control materials for larval mosquito control. About 85% of the larval control we do is done with a natural soil bacterium called BTI. It stands for Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. It's a natural occurring soil bacterium that are found in wetland settings all over the world. It's put on ground-up corncob granules. We apply the corncob granules, and when the corncob granules go into the water where the mosquitoes are developing, the bacterium flashes off. The mosquito larvae feed on it. It mixes up with the chemicals in their stomach. The bacterium becomes activated, and it ulcerates their stomachs, and that's the way they're controlled. The nice thing about BTI is it's very specific to mosquitoes and a few closely related flies. Most aquatic organisms that take in BTI in the wetlands don't have the same kind of chemical makeup in their stomach. The bacterium doesn't become activated, and they aren't affected by it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Mr. Shark, wasn't one of those kind of developed by a local person?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the methoprene product that we've shown here is another product that we use. It's called an insect growth regulator, and the way that product affects mosquitoes is mosquitoes have juvenile hormones in their system that tell them now it's time to turn into a larva, now it's time to turn into a pupa, and then eventually an adult mosquito. When you introduce these juvenile hormones into the mosquito system as it's developing, it never reaches adulthood, so it stays in the larval and pupal form. And that was developed by our previous director, Dr. Robert Shogren, back in the mid-1980s.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Stark, do other mosquito control districts use that product, and was there revenue generated off of that for our district?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, there was revenue generated from that, and primarily through we've got a significant price break on the materials that we use. The patent has since run out, and it's now being manufactured by another corporation. But it is still, methoprene is still used widely by a number of mosquito abatement districts around the country.
Yeah.
Mr. Stark.
And so, as I say, larval control is done. It's about 85% of the control that we do is done towards immature mosquitoes while they're developing in the water. Larger sites are treated with a helicopter. Again, everything that comes out of the helicopter is a dry granular formulation, either of this methoprene product or primarily that BTI product. The smaller sites are treated by hand with a handheld seeder, usually 3 acres or less. We can get our field inspectors in and be able to do a pretty good job with a handheld seeder. We also do some adult control. Adult control is done with a couple of materials. They're called synthetic pyrethroids. We do adult control two different ways. One is called a space spray. That's out of a truck-mounted machine. We put the material out in a large fog, a lot of small particles that stay suspended in the air for a period of time. The adult mosquitoes fly through that fog, come in contact with the control material, and are killed by that. The other way we do adult mosquito control is a barrier treatment, as you see on the right-hand part of this slide. We'll take another control material, impinge the vegetation where mosquitoes harbor during the daytime. When the adult mosquitoes walk through that material on that leaf and vegetation, they'll take in some of the control material, and that's how they're affected by it. We try to be environmentally sensitive with these two control materials. They're used at a very low dosage rate, and at times when most beneficial insects are in the hive. What I will say here is that certainly adult control is more broad spectrum. has the capacity to be more impactful. And one of the things, one of the charges that I've had over the last 5 years since I've been the executive director is I'm trying to expand our larval control capacity to reduce the reliance on adult control. We're always going to have a need for adult control because when we have disease-bearing mosquitoes that are active and out there and we think are in the process of transmitting disease, we're going to have an immediate reaction to that. But certainly our program is an IPM program that's predicated on trying to get the mosquitoes controlled before they become adults. One of the things that's really changed here over the last few years is the technology with which we use to do mosquito control. The first slide I've got on the left-hand slide here, everything we do now is done, put in a PDA when our inspectors are out in the field. They enter the information into a PDA. That's the data set you see on the bottom there. Gives us real-time information on the control efforts we're doing, where we're doing things, and as I say, we can manipulate, look at the data sets, and be as efficient as possible. The other technology that's having a significant impact on mosquito control is the global positioning system, global information system technology. We see on the upper right-hand slide there is a GIS system in one of our helicopters. What we do now is we put shape files into a file. We give the flash drive to the helicopter pilot. He puts it into his machine, comes up exactly where we want a certain area treated, where we want the control material to go. And what we get back from the pilot is on the bottom of that, right underneath the apparatus, give us an idea of where the helicopter flew, when the control material was on, when it was off, where the helicopter flew. So it gives us an opportunity to be very specific with our operations and where we apply control materials. West Nile virus is probably our primary disease concern. West Nile virus is primarily a bird virus. It's maintained by hundreds of bird species in the United States. And what happens is the birds are infected. Mosquitoes will feed on infected birds. They and themselves become infected, then bite other birds, infect other birds. And then later in the summer, those mosquitoes, for whatever reason, kind of change their feeding patterns and can bridge over and will feed on humans and horses. Pardon me. So we can get some disease transmission primarily in the latter part of the summer, August and September, with regards to West Nile virus. Last year, we had a very wet year to do mosquito control. We had significant rainfall. We had over 5 inches above normal rainfall from May through September in most of the metropolitan area. So normally, in a normal year, we'll treat between 150 and 200,000 acres for immature mosquitoes to try to keep them from hatching. Last year, we treated upwards of 300,000 acres, so a very busy year for us. But what we didn't see was a lot of virus activity. We saw a lot of the mosquito vectors out there, but for whatever reason, we don't understand the dynamic of West Nile virus very well yet. There wasn't a lot of virus activity in the birds, didn't get a high infection rate in the mosquitoes. We didn't have a whole lot of virus transmission. We only had 8 human cases of West Nile virus in Minnesota in 2010, and I used this presentation in a Washington County board. We didn't have any cases in Washington County, so... that compares with 2003, we had about 175 cases of West Nile virus in Minnesota. Culex tarsalis, that's one of the 50 types of mosquitoes that transmits or that bites humans, and it's the probable vector of West Nile virus in Minnesota and states west of the Mississippi River. It's associated with long-term standing water and irrigation runoff. Remember I said that those mosquitoes like to lay their eggs on more permanent habitat. Culex pipiens and Culex restuans are another couple species of mosquitoes that can transmit West Nile virus. They're associated with man-made habitats, catch basins, areas that we use to manage stormwater. We have 70,000 stormwater catch basins in the 7-county metro that we visit from time to time. In fact, we treat them each 3 times throughout the summer. That resulted in 227,000 catch basins being treated in 2010. And what we do is catch basins are designed to take water and take silt and leaves and debris out of the storm water and then move the water kind of down the pipeline into a holding pond or into a river or stream. Some of them are designed pretty well where they flush through pretty cleanly. Others are designed with this little cement kind of pond in the bottom, and it's a perfect habitat for these mosquitoes. So we've identified the catch basins in the metro that produce mosquitoes, and we treat them on a regular basis. There are other man-made structures in the metropolitan area. We've got a culvert here that doesn't drain completely at the end. It's got some riprap. It's another really good place for these mosquitoes. And they'll find any of these little niches to develop in. And we treated about 2,800 acres of those other man-made structures last year. The other issue for us is waste tires. A number of species of mosquitoes that transmit disease develop in waste tires. So we're continually out there looking for and trying to properly dispose of waste tires. We recycled about 23,445 tires in 2010.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Robley.
Mr. Stark, when you recycle waste tires, is there a charge to the generators of the tires, or how do you recover costs for that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, no, there isn't a cost. We just we have some cooperative agreements with some of the associated with the county environmental health departments who fund us through that, but primarily the recycling costs come from our program. We work closely with cities and communities who do cleanup days. We'll go and get their tires and properly dispose of them for them. We try to keep fairly good track of who's calling us with regards to waste tires, because what we don't want to have happen, I mean, what we're concerned with is waste tires that are out in the environment that can be used as by mosquitoes to develop in. We don't want someone taking four tires off their car and then just giving us a call and saying, you know, come and get these tires and recycle them for us. So we try to keep track of who we have and how we manage that. We may go to someone in the first time and say, you know, we'll take these tires now, but if they're not in a woodland setting, that's up to you to do in the future.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stark, how much of the budget is appropriated toward waste tire removal and recycling? Or do you have an agreement with somebody who uses these for another purpose?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Senator Roebling, we have an agreement with both Dakota and Carver County that they reimburse us for some of the cost, and we get charged by the pound, and I'll have to get back to you with regards to exactly what we pay, what portion. It's a fairly small portion of the overall budget to get those tires recycled.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Stark, just to follow up on Senator Roebling's comments there, and I'm new to this committee, so I'm wondering why you guys are even taking care of this. Why doesn't this fall under a municipality's nuisance ordinance right now?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not quite sure. You know, we've taken on the responsibility for that because it is a disease concern for us. The mosquitoes that develop in these waste tires can transmit disease, so it's important for the program, important for the public health aspect of the program to recycle the tires. And so we've done it. We've had the resources to do it, and it's certainly a service that the metropolitan citizens appreciate.
Senator Peterson.
To follow up, Chair, and Mr. Stark, I mean, is this an area that you think your department could save some money? Because, you know, clearly, you know, having served on the city council, I could almost guarantee that every municipality has ordinances that do not allow waste tires to lay around on somebody's lot. Do you see that as an area of cost savings? Or
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and Senator, certainly, you know, we're spending money doing it, so it would save money for us. I don't know, just transferring the cost to the cities or the municipalities, how efficient that might be. You know, we try to work as closely as we can with those municipalities now, at least to try to make it as efficient as possible. But certainly, you know, it would be saving for us if we don't have to recycle the tires.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Stark, where Senator Peterson has us going is if the cost should be shifted to the responsible party, the property owner in the city or whoever's got the tire. Is there any effort to, we're not a finance committee, but is there any effort to recover any of the costs that you incur doing that?
Mr. Chair, we haven't sought to get that transferred. You know, we've been able to handle it within our budget and have been, you know, as I say, it's a fairly important aspect of our program, and we're happy to do it. I know we don't have any enforcement authority, and I know we've worked with the PCA and the DNR when they've identified large tire piles. We've worked closely, in fact, and a couple of the larger tire dumps, maybe within some of your legislative districts. We've worked along with MPCA to get rid of some of those tires, but we've not sought any kind of legislative action to shift that responsibility.
Any other questions?
I'll quickly mention here La Crosse encephalitis. It's another virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes. Not a lot of cases, only 3 to 12 cases per year throughout the entire state of Minnesota. It's most often diagnosed in children under the age of 16. The interesting thing about this mosquito is its natural habitat is areas and trees that hold water and get some vegetation in there. And it's called a tree hole mosquito. And so we are always looking for areas and trees that might hold water, and then we'll take the water out of there, put a little cap or fill it up and try to eliminate that habitat. They're very daytime active mosquitoes, which is kind of different than most of our species of mosquitoes, so they do interface with the kids that are out there playing in the summertime. And they are pretty local. You know, they seldom fly more than about 100 yards from where they develop. We've got some species of mosquitoes that will travel 20 to 30 miles over their 4 or 5 week lifespan in the summer, but these mosquitoes stay pretty close to home. And they also like to use waste tires. So when we tell people to police their neighborhoods, get rid of anything in an artificial setting that can hold water, produce mosquitoes, it really does have an impact on their own neighborhood with regards to these types of mosquitoes. Lyme disease, we monitor the distribution of deer ticks in the metropolitan area. Lyme disease became a reportable disease back in the early 1980s. We really don't have any good way to control the ticks that transmit Lyme disease. Lyme disease is transmitted by deer ticks, which are much smaller than our normal wood ticks. So public education is the main focus to reduce the risk of Lyme disease. We work very closely with the Minnesota Department of Health, crafting our messages and trying to get people to know if they live, work, or play in areas where they may come in contact with Lyme disease ticks, what the ticks look like, what some of the symptoms of Lyme disease are, and then some measures they can take to try to keep from coming in contact with the ticks if they are going to be in areas that deer ticks are habitating. Reported cases of Lyme disease have been trending upward fairly significantly since the 1980s. Over the last few years, we used to see about 300 or 400 cases a year in Minnesota. Last couple of years, we've seen over 1,000 cases. And that is true again in 2009. Lyme disease are over 1,065 reported cases in Minnesota. There are two other mosquito-transmitted disease, human granulocytic ehrlichiosis, and babesiosis. The HGE is another bacterial disease that's transmitted by the same Lyme ticks the same deer ticks that transmit Lyme disease. Babesiosis is a protozoan. It's a malaria-like disease that's transmitted by ticks also. And within the metropolitan area last year, we had 144 cases reported in people, residents in the 7-county metro area, 84 HGE and 10 babesiosis. And generally 25% of the reported cases are exposed in the county of residence. So you can figure about a quarter of all those bottom numbers were exposed locally in the counties that were reported in Minnesota. We also do black fly control. These are biting gnats that develop in the river systems. We treat immature biting gnats with a liquid formulation of that same soil bacterium, BTI. We dump it into the rivers and streams as it flows downstream. These black fly larvae are attached to the substrate. They're filter feeders. They take in a little of that bacterium and, again, interferes with their digestion. We do that under permit with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. As part of that permitting process, we do a lot of non-target sampling to make sure that we're not having an impact on any other aquatic organisms within our stream and river systems. Notification, this is my final slide. We really are trying to get people, my background is in mass communications. We're really trying to get people to know who we are, what we do, and we do that in a number of different ways. We take out paid advertisements. We do it through treatment postings. We post the main entrances to any public land that we do control, at least adult control, in the metropolitan area. We have an adult mosquito and a helicopter notification line. On any given day in the summer, a citizen can call that phone number and find out where we've got adult mosquito control scheduled or where the helicopters are going to be flying. That's updated on a daily basis. In fact, it's updated twice a day in the summertime. We have internet postings. That same information is posted on our website. Our website is www.mmcd.org. We also will do an individual notification. If a person has concerns about a helicopter or they are chemically sensitive, if they want to know if we're going to be doing something in their area, we will call them individually and let them know that we're going to be in the area. Public outreach. We have a speakers bureau. We make presentations. We have booths at the state and county fairs. We do school programs really try to get our message out. The final thing I'll mention is that the one thing that we added to our website in 2009 is that people can go on our website, type in their address, and a map will come up and it'll show all the wetlands in the area. They can find out exactly what we've done in their neighborhood, what kind of control materials we're using, and if they've got any questions, they can give us a call. With that, there's my contact information. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the chair or committee members might have.
Senator Roble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stark, would you remind us where your budget comes from and how big it is?
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Roebling, our budget comes from the counties. We have a dedicated real estate tax that is based on tax capacity, property valuation. In the metropolitan area, on a $250,000 property value, you pay a property owner would pay about $11.80 for mosquito control. And our budget, our levy in 2011 is $16.7 million.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And does that all come from the property tax levy, or are there some other sources of revenue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the vast majority of that comes from the property tax. There are some miscellaneous revenues, about less than 2%, come from investments. And then we still also do get about $500,000 from the state, kind of a leftover HACA. It comes from agricultural credits. Other than that, the majority of it comes from the property tax levy from the counties.
Okay, any other questions from members? With that, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Stark, I'm not sure who would be the best person to answer this, but I guess I'm a little bit unclear then. The reason why this state committee deals with this, is that because of the $500,000 in funding? If this is primarily financed by counties, is it because it's a taxing district that this state committee is dealing with it?
Encompasses the metro area, and it was created by the legislature. But the budget itself is coming from through the counties, correct?
Yes.
So we don't oversee the budget as coming through the property tax, but the legislature authorized the levy. Is that correct, Mr. Starr?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, our enabling statutes are formed under state government.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So do all of the counties, when they join this, they all agree to levy the same amount? So there's an equal distribution of how the levy is made, or is there a formula, or how does that occur? So is it pretty much an average on a $250,000 home, as you mentioned, it would be about $11.80 a year throughout the district?
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, yes, they certainly don't put in the same amount. It's based on tax capacity and property valuation. So each of the counties puts in. There is a formula that we get from the Department of Finance, and that formula is applied to the property valuation of the county, and they give us the number that they get through the formula. So, for example, $16.7 million in 2011, Hennepin County pays about $7 million of that, or a little over $7 million of that, because of the tax capacity property valuation within Hennepin County, and the smaller counties paying less.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stark, what have been the increases in the levy in recent years? Say in the last 5 years, has it been fairly stable levy, or what are the percent of increases?
Mr. Starr.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, when I became the director in 2006, I had a fairly ambitious growth program. We were trying to expand, as I said, we're trying to expand the organization's reach and the ability to do larval control throughout the seven metro counties. We didn't have enough resources to do that, so we're trying to expand our capacity to do larval control to lessen our reliance on adult control. So we kind of front-ended some of that. Our levy was going up by 4 or 5% back in 2005 and 2006. And then when we started to have these significant financial issues, you know, our county board is certainly sensitive to the effect property taxes have on metro citizens. So in 2000, as I said, in 2009, we reduced our levy by 5%. And in 2010, we've kept our levy flat. And we will continue to respond, I think, to our current economic situation. I've been asking staff to identify ways to improve our processes, to become more efficient, to do more with less or the same, and we're certainly going to continue in that vein.
Yeah. Other questions? There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.